find the defendants incredibly guilty.
I find this ultimate chicken sandwich on brioche bun to be guilty of being delicious.
Right.
What section of the Constitution has been breached?
There is no one section. It's just the vibe of the thing.
Objection, Your Honor.
What?
He's leading the witness.
Say.
You break, we're both lawyers.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 2 billion, because it feels like you're hearing from us an awful lot lately, but hopefully that's a good thing. 258, how's it going, Andrew?
It is going fantastically well, even though, yeah, we've been at this recording thing for quite a while, but there's just too much great law stuff in the news that we've got to get out.
There really is. I'm told we're talking about Title 10. Today, which I don't know if this is just Andrew doing the Trump thing of like, well, 5G, why not 6G? Just make 6G. Is it that? It's like, well, we have Title 9. We know we talk about that a lot. Why not Title 10?
Yeah, no, this is a really, really important issue. It is part of the Trump administration's ongoing war on women. It is yet another point. We just spent 2 episodes kind of talking about rule of law type stuff. And I have talked to liberals, I will not out them on the show, you know, who have said, hey, you know, on the ground, nobody really cares about this Russia stuff. What we care about is, you know, are things like, you know, trade deals and war and, you know, Trump hasn't gone to war and he's not using drones and, you know, and stuff like that. This is another piece of ammunition when you're in those discussions for how has the fact that Donald Trump has outsourced the entirety of his political wing to the farthest right wing of the Republican Party, how is that making real life real bad for real women? That's what this is about.
Oh, fun.
Yay! So maybe fantastic wasn't the right way to describe my mood. Yeah, this is really important. I'm really glad.
Really important. They're the hardest shows to do, but they probably are the most important because we need to know how much cleanup there is to do in, you know, 6 years when we get Trump out of office, how much there will be to clean up. Just trolling you, but kind of not really. All right. And then we're also going to talk about click wrap agreements. And now this sounds, I'm very scared of this, sign in wrap agreement. That sounds like I've given all that. I agree to whatever. I don't care. I don't read anything. I hope somebody will work it out. I've got enough on my plate. I'm not going to read through a contract that I click on for some software or website that I don't care about, but we're going to talk about that. That's a very real issue in the legal world. So sounds less bad than the main segment, but also not terribly fun. We'll see. This is going to be one of those shows that could be depressing, but that's just because we live in a depressing world. So we'd better get on it. All right. Title 10. Tell us about how Trump is continuing his war on women.
Yeah. So Title 10 is 42 U.S. Code 300 and afterwards. It is a program dating back to Opening Arguments' good friend Richard Nixon from 1970. And it is the Population Research and Voluntary Family Planning Program Act of 1970. It is the only federal grant program that is dedicated to providing low-income Americans with comprehensive family planning and preventative health services. You probably know where this is going. So the way Title 10 works is that the implementing legislation authorizes the Secretary of Health and Human Services to make grants and enter into contracts with public or nonprofit private entities to assist in the establishment and operation of voluntary family planning projects, which shall, and again, I'm quoting from the law here, offer a broad range of acceptable and effective planning methods and services, including natural family planning methods, infertility services, and services for adolescents. Again, from the statute, to the extent practical, entities which receive grants or contracts under the subsection shall encourage family participation in projects assisted under this subsection. What does that mean? So the law authorizes the government to spend money on family planning projects for low-income people. That this is one of these laws that requires implementing regulations. And the Trump administration has just rolled out a whole host of horrible new regulations with respect to the Implementing Act. Let's be clear. I am flagging this up front. The Title 10 program does not provide funding for abortions. No federal program provides direct funding for abortions. It provides family planning, and again, as you saw the language in the statute, right? The family planning includes natural family planning, which you know, reminds me of a joke that a Catholic priest used to tell me, which was, we have a special name in the Catholic Church for those who follow the rhythm method of contraception. Those people are called parents. But nevertheless, that's what, quote, natural family planning is supposed to mean. But the Title X services are, or Title 10 services are, family planning, contraception, education, counseling, breast and pelvic exams, breast and cervical cancer screening, screenings and treatments for sexually transmitted infections and HIV, education about preventing STIs and HIV, and referrals to other healthcare resources, pregnancy diagnosis, and pregnancy counseling. As you might imagine, Planned Parenthood receives approximately 25% of Title X's grants. And again, not one dime can be spent on abortion. However, that's not good enough for the extreme right wing in our country. And they have been, despite the fact that Title X was not at all controversial through the Reagan administration, through the first George H.W. Bush administration, through the second George W. Bush administration, all of a sudden it became controversial when Obama was president. Mm. Yeah, it's funny how that works. And so you can look through, because the initial act allocated $70 million in funds in 1970 and escalated up to $158 million in 1985. And so if you go to one of those websites that has the like helpful calculator of, you know, what's $158 million in today's dollars? Yeah, it's $369 million in today's dollars. So if it had grown at an appropriate rate, it would be $369 million today. It's $250 million today. It actually peaked at around $300 million in 2010. That's when the Howler, in 2010, I wonder what happened. Yeah, the Howler monkey contingent of Congress took over and they slashed Title X funding. Not because Title X money goes to abortions. It does not, but because 25% of it goes to Planned Parenthood. I will tell you that the Guttmacher Institute, which is a nonpartisan, although it is scored in today's world, it is scored as left-leaning because facts are left-leaning, but it is a nonpartisan women's health research think tank. The Guttmacher Institute claims that the effect of Title X is to greatly decrease the number of abortions in the United States. That's not a hard argument to follow. And in fact, they submitted a brief to the court. This was in 2006, but you know, the numbers are reasonably consistent over time. That Title X helped women avoid nearly 2 million unwanted, unintended pregnancies, right? So education, contraceptions, they estimate 1.94 million unintended pregnancies. And then just math right? The number of unintended pregnancies that result in abortion, preventing about 810,000 abortions per year. So if you think abortion is a terrible thing, you should be pro Title X, but of course you're not. Obviously, without the kinds of funds that Title X provides, the number of unintended pregnancies and abortions in the United States would be significantly higher. The Guttmacher Institute estimates 2/3 higher among women overall and among teens, and that the number of unintended pregnancies among poor women would double. So I could also talk about how, again, rather like the Affordable Care Act and its attempt, particularly in the early stages, to focus on preventative care, investing money in education and contraception is significantly cheaper than having women who lack access to health care and don't intend to get pregnant, who then get pregnant and incur costs on Medicaid, for example, for girls under the age of 18, and for, you know, additional spillover effects. Again, the Guttmacher Institute estimates that every dollar spent on preventative care results in a savings of $3.74 costs that otherwise get passed on to Medicaid. So obviously, this is a great bipartisan program. You're asking, how could Trump screw this up? I'm going to let you take one crack at it.
I don't understand.
Yeah. So like,
I felt like he could easily screw it. How could he not screw it? I guess is what I'm wondering.
Exactly right.
Can he just direct all the money to, rather than good organizations that actually do good things, just direct them to some BS like Christian organizations that don't help anybody with anything, really?
Oh, that is certainly part of the new Title X regulations. Yep.
Partial credit.
So, yeah, partial credit. You want to take another guess? Like, you're missing kind of the top line story.
Oh, I am? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I think there's actually a good reason for this. So, as I started to read through, this hasn't been covered much at all because I guess there's only so much public appetite for horrible and
well, you know, yeah, Cohen is taking all that up right now.
Cohen is sucking a lot of the oxygen out of the room, and this is an awful thing. What coverage there is calling this the gag rule. I think that is terrible and stupid branding. I know why they're doing it, right? Because it mirrors the international gag rule in there. Yeah, but what they should be calling is, this is defunding Planned Parenthood through Title X. The new promulgated regulations include, and I'm going to talk about several of the most critical aspects. I'm going to link the entire final rule in the show notes, but it's like 400 pages long. So none of you are going to read it. I have read it, so you don't have to. But it specifically says in multiple sections, the clearest one is section 5915. And this is 42 CFR section 5915. Would require physical and financial separation of any recipient of any Title X project, that is, of any Title X dollars or facility, from any prohibited activities, specifically meaning abortion as a method of family planning. So in other words, a Planned Parenthood may not receive Title X funds. And again, I go back to the list of what those are. None of those are abortion, right? Title X funds for Title X services. Those are breast and pelvic exams, cervical cancer, breast cancer screening, contraception, education, treatment on sexually transmitted infections and HIV. A Planned Parenthood or any other provider may not receive those funds unless they are physically separated from the facility that performs abortions, unless they are economically separated. And in the case of Planned Parenthood, like, that's impossible, right? I mean, that essentially what this is going to do is strip Planned Parenthood of all of its federal funding.
Because I thought, find where I'm wrong here. I thought the whole thing about the international gag order is that the reason they could do it was that other countries don't have constitutional rights that we have. So like they're able to say, oh, we'll just take away all your money if you do any abortion things because you don't have any protections of that. But I thought they couldn't do that in this country in that same way because abortion is legal and you have the right to, you know, like that would be infringing on people's beliefs or people's rights in some way that is protected. How are they allowed to do this? Or am I wrong in my assumptions somewhere?
No, I think you're correct in your assumptions. And look, as of today, this final rule came out 2 days ago. As of today, several states, including Washington and California, have stated their intent to file lawsuits. I'm going to talk about, generally speaking, you know, where those lawsuits are likely to go. They have not yet been filed, so we can't talk about it. But I can give you some of the arguments that I think they're likely to raise. But right now, there certainly is, and let me say, I think there are good arguments to raise against this final rule. However, when you were talking about administering a program that delegates from Congress to the administrative agency how to run that program, There certainly are ways to run the program that nevertheless would discriminate against constitutionally held rights. I'm not confident that this final rule is going to succeed. I certainly hope that the courts strike it down.
The executive has all the power over whatever, you know, if they've been delegated the power, but they can't say, oh, okay, whites only for this money. Like they can't do that, right?
Yes, absolutely. They can't do that. But
so
the
there
question
is some
is,
restriction. So where right. I guess where's
but,
the
but
line?
Remember, so here, look, and again, I'm making the devil's advocate argument for the mm-hmm. other side. The argument for the other side would be, look, when we passed Title X and then subsequently amended it, it specifically says that no money go to abortions under Title X. Mm. So this is not about discriminating on the basis of a constitutional right. You can have a constitutional right to something, and yet we don't have to fund it at the federal level. That hasn't been controversial. And these regulations just clarify and on their implementation, you know, make it cleaner that no Title X funds are going to be spent on abortion. That's the argument they're going to make.
Yeah. Well, that's depressing. What more depressing stuff do you have for us?
I have plenty more.
I'm guessing that's
depressing
not it.
Stuff. Yeah. Yeah. No. There is more because should be depressed. And so let's first say this rule itself is about abortion, right? There's a tiny, tiny bit, and again, in a multi-hundred page document, there's a tiny bit about, you know, funding for, you know, for various other women's health issues. But sentence one of the summary starts with, the point of this rule is to regulate abortion. That's the only reason that this has been passed, and it is entirely the result of Donald Trump having outsourced his policy to the farthest right wing of the Republican Party. As a result, Title X funds are going to be pulled from Planned Parenthood. I want to also talk about some of the specific provisions that are a part of this final rule. I'm going to go just in numerical order because I tend to do that sort of thing. Let's start off with 59.7. And again, remember, these are the Health and Human Services regulations that guide the interpretation of how the law is to be interpreted, right? 59.7 says preference will be given, quote, for Title X recipients, quote, especially among a broad range of partners and diverse subrecipients and individual and referral individuals and organizations, and among non-traditional Title X partnering organizations, end of quote. You get one guess as to what non-traditional Title X partnering organizations.
Is that what I was saying earlier? It's going to be.
Yes. Yeah. It absolutely means that it will be.
Going to be using the astrology to prevent pregnancy and crap, other crap, Christian timing, abstinence only stuff or something.
Yeah, we It will go to crisis pregnancy centers, 100%. That this is designed to make it easier for evangelical Christian ministries disguising themselves as Planned Parenthood and as pregnancy centers as places that provide medical services. It will make it 100% easier for those organizations to get federal tax dollars to proselytize to scared young women who think they're going into a Planned Parenthood. There already is on the books an act called the Charitable Choice Act. Don't have time to go through all of it, but the terms of that act specify that faith-based organizations cannot be excluded from federal funding opportunities. So they have the right to compete for these grants. The Charitable Choice Act requires faith-based organizations to, quote, separate their religious activities from government-funded activities in time and location. And so I went to a crisis pregnancy center website talking about how they apply for Title X funds, and they say, oh, yeah, we found ways to effectively separate prayer and gospel presentations from government-funded services, often by using specially trained spiritual counselors to provide spiritual services at a separate time and location from the federally funded service. So just so we're clear on this, Planned Parenthood is being barred from receiving Title X funds because a separate wing of Planned Parenthood performs abortions. Never minding the fact that Planned Parenthood is, when they give out contraception, that's not a direct referral to, to an abortion, because presumably you get the contraception first. But while the fungibility argument is being used to indict Planned Parenthood funds, it is being used directly to invite in church-based organizations that will use the money to proselytize to scared young women. That's pretty bad. The reason, so let's move on. Next provision, 59.14 provides that a Title X project may not perform, promote, refer for, or support abortion as a method of family planning, nor take any other affirmative action to assist a patient to secure such an abortion. This is the provision that is getting this bill called, that is getting this final rule called the gag rule. And it's correct with respect to that. That is sweepingly broad, right? It says that you may not receive Title X funds and promote or support or refer in any way a patient for an abortion. Doctors have already weighed in and said that that is unconscionable, that their ethical obligation as a doctor is to recommend the most efficacious course of treatment for their patients. And there are cases in which the most efficacious mode of treatment for a young woman who is suffering with a dangerous pregnancy is to refer them for an abortion, right? This is the old, right, life of the mother exception. The way I read this provision contains no exception for referring out for the safety or life of the mother.
Wow.
It means that if... And if you don't think that the people that sneak into Planned Parenthood and then splice together fake videos to show them ostensibly selling body parts, if you don't think that they're going to be out there, you know, trying to police this, then, you know, you haven't been paying attention the past 10 years. That's what 5914 does. It is an absolute gag order. It prevents any Title X recipient from mentioning the A word, even if the doctor thinks, hey, you've come in and this is really, really dangerous right now. And an abortion is going to be, what is best for your health. The minute you utter those words, that organization can forfeit its Title X funding. Are you fully depressed yet, or can I do a couple more?
Yes and yes.
Yeah. So already talked about 5915. That is the physical and financial separation. 5916 is the proposed rule that says a Title X project may not encourage, promote, or advocate abortion as a method for family planning. This restriction prohibits actions to assist women to obtain abortions or to increase the availability or accessibility of abortion for family planning purposes. So just in case the previous one was not clear enough, right? You can't refer out, you cannot take any other affirmative action. This means you cannot take any action in any way to assist women to obtain abortions. You may not give them a list that has abortion providers on it. It's as comprehensive as it gets.
So to anyone who thought, oh, Trump is actually, you know, he has a New York liberal. He's got lots of liberal values, really. I mean, he's pro-choice. No, it doesn't. It doesn't matter what he had in his heart, what he believed, whatever in his heart of heart. It doesn't matter. Matters is what he does and what he would need to do to stay in power. And it's the worst right-wing stuff yet, I think.
Yeah, because those are the only group, that's the only group that still supports Trump. Yeah. And they support him overwhelmingly. And he's got to continue feeding them red meat or then instead, right? Because they support him 97-3. And that just about gets him to 38% in the polls. And if he loses the extreme right wing, you know, just a couple of points there, right, then all of a sudden now he's going to be in the mid-30s or the low-30s. And, you know, if I know this, then I promise you Kellyanne Conway knows this. And that's what they're doing. Prior to this rule coming out, Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings, in the news quite a bit these days, sent a letter to HHS documenting all of the ways in which promulgating this rule potentially violated the Administrative Procedure Act. Right. So I told you lawsuits are coming. California, Washington, probably New York, probably other states will join in on this. This is going to be tied up in litigation for a while. I already said I think that there are some grounds for the Trump administration to do something like this. But if you want optimism, I'm going to include Cummings' letter in the show notes. I'm going to tell you a little bit about it right here. But basically, he identifies defects in the transparency in announcing the rule. So, for example, Cummings says, last May, the office accepted the draft rule with no advance public notice. The proposed rule did not appear on either the fall 2017 or spring 2018 regulatory agenda, and there was no outreach to Planned Parenthood and to other recipients who might be affected by the new rule.
Now, is that shadiness or incompetence?
Yeah, the beautiful part is it doesn't matter.
Oh, I know, right? It doesn't matter. I'm just wondering what you think. Do you think they're trying to sneak this in, or do they just not know how government works?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, ordinarily, right? Boy, you've pitted against me. You know, on the one hand, my maxim of never attribute to malice what can adequately be explained by incompetence. On the other hand, those kind of stealth techniques are the kinds of things that these advocates use all the time. So I would probably be inclined to the latter, but yeah, I wouldn't be surprised by the former.
This is something I'm sure they've thought through. they put a lot of time and effort into these efforts. Hey, listeners, Opening Arguments is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. It is so important to continue educating ourselves, staying curious about the topics that affect our everyday lives. That's why you're listening to this show, and that is also why we recommend checking out The Great Courses Plus. This week's recommended course to check out over on The Great Courses Plus is The History of the Supreme Court. Couldn't be more relevant to what we talk about every week on this show. You get to learn about how the court has evolved over its 200-plus year history, the cases that have shaped our country and the court itself. And this is the perfect course for Opening Arguments listeners to get started with. But maybe you don't want to go with my recommendation. Maybe you want to choose another course. That's okay, because The Great Courses Plus has thousands of lectures. And with The Great Courses Plus, you get unlimited access to the entire library. Stream it anytime you want, any course you want. Learn about anything from top experts, history, politics, business, or how to speak a new language, or how to learn to cook. Watch or listen anytime, anywhere with the Great Courses Plus app. To help you get started, we've arranged a special limited time offer for our listeners. Enjoy a full month of the Great Courses Plus for free. But to start your free month, you must sign up through our special URL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. Sign up today. One more time. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA for opening arguments. Give it a try.
Yeah. Going on, and part of what tips the balance, in my view, in that, right, in favor of malice, is the Trump administration was asked to extend the notice and comment period on the rulemaking. They declined. Within the comment period, as Congressman Cummings says, quote, numerous major medical associations, 15 governors, 200 members of Congress, and more than 20 state and local health departments, more than 500,000 members of the public submitted comments opposing the rule, which, as we saw with Ajit Pai and the FCC gutting net neutrality, those comments were, you know, instantly placed in the dumpster. But in terms of the procedural defects, the one that I found the most interesting is that Health and Human Services did not rule that their proposed rulemaking would be, quote, economically significant, end quote. It's hard to imagine how it could not be. But the fact that they made that determination means, you know, has particular implications for how the rule gets passed and what level of scrutiny and what level of deference is due to their interpretations. So if I had to guess right now, and again, I haven't seen the lawsuits yet because they have not yet been filed. It's probably going to take a week or so for them to get cranked up and filed. I would guess that the challenge to the implementation of the rule under the Administrative Procedure Act is going to be sort of the least sexy, but probably the most interesting potential challenge to this. What's going to grab the headlines are the First Amendment arguments that you made, are the it's inconsistent with the constitutional right to an abortion. And I'm not saying that there isn't some validity to those arguments, but I think if this is going to be stopped, it's going to be stopped on the APA grounds. It's going to be stopped on the fact that they tried to ram it through without the without following the appropriate rules. And look, the remedy for that is, you know, to put the rule on hold and go back and do it properly. And maybe we can run out the clock until, you know, we elect a Democrat in 2020. That would be where I would go. We're going to have to find out.
It's going to be interesting for Planned Parenthood, you know, I guess kind of business wise to be like, do we just try to survive this, you know, 2 years of a lot less funding somehow, you know, tighten our belts and just hope we can ride it out. It's interesting.
I would be shocked. I haven't spoken with anyone at Planned Parenthood. I would be shocked if they don't do that, right? Like
it's not like it necessarily might be that easy to do that. Who knows what they're, you know, how much you said this is a lot of money that they take in.
No, that's right. And I couldn't get the precise numbers. I know that Planned Parenthood receives 25%, approximately 25% of all of the Title X funding, right? So that is on the order of about $50 million, right? That's actually closer to 70. So significant chunk of money. There are only 91 recipients of Title X funds, and Planned Parenthood is by far the largest of it. So it's a big, big deal. What I meant by I think that that's what they're going to do is I think they're not going to try and comply with these regulations, right? Everything I've said sort of from the outset. They're not going to say, we'll segregate out, right? That would because the counseling requirements, I think.
I mean, I kind of thought they already had done that a lot to comply with, you know, other times when Republicans or, well, I guess it's somewhat bipartisan sometimes, but when Congress has made them not use any funds for abortion, I thought they kind of already had segregated out that part of what they're doing. But is it just that this would be probably impossible for them to do and still be the organization that they are because of how strict they're trying to make these requirements?
Exactly. Because of the subsection 15 and the physical and financial separation, right? Like there's really no way to do it. And even if they could, then you would have, you know, doctors who work at Planned Parenthood clinics would would still be subject to the gag rule requirements, right? Like they would not be able to mention. Oh, they don't cause them to
give bad advice.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. Well, I'm thoroughly depressed. Anything else? Or can we go on to something?
No, maybe. Let's move on to a less...
Let's talk click wrap, browse wrap, and now sign in wrap agreements. Ugh. Hey, listeners, getting fit and staying healthy always sounds easier said than done. Well, maybe not. OpenFit is bringing you something that makes it even easier to never miss a sweat session. Lose the commute to the gym and let the workouts come to you. OpenFit takes all the complexity out of losing weight and getting fit. It's a brand new, super simple streaming service that allows you to work out from the comfort of your living room in as little as 10 minutes a day. And I'll tell you, that's key. I had a gym membership for years that I barely used because it's always so hard to get motivated to drive out, adding the extra barrier of, oh, is there going to be traffic? How long is it going to take? Do I have to time it around the rush hour? Oh, when, you know, how am I going to do this? Get rid of all of that and try out OpenFit. And you know, everyone's bodies are different and OpenFit gets that, which is why it has personalized workouts to your needs with custom tailored original content. It's very simple. You forget all the complexity and stress around getting fit and just push play on and work out on your schedule. And it's got all the ease of access anywhere you need it. That's on your computer, web-enabled TV, tablet, smartphone, and Roku. And get results you can see. Lose up to 15 pounds in just the first 30 days. Flatten your abs, shape your body, and look and feel great. My favorite thing about OpenFit is being able to do it at home and on my own convenience, especially because I have a very weird schedule. You know, I got to schedule stuff, work here and there, recordings when I can do them. They're always different. You know, they might come up at a moment's notice. So having that flexibility to do a routine that I need, that's the length of time that I need whenever I want it, is really key. OpenFit has changed the way I work out. And with our code OA, you can join us on a fitness journey personalized just for you. Again, use our code OA and start using OpenFit for your journey to a healthier life. And right now, during the OpenFit 30-day challenge, our listeners get a special extended 30-day free trial membership to OpenFit, where you can lose up to 15 pounds in 30 days when you text OA to 303030. That's just the number 303030. You will get full access to OpenFit, all the workouts, and all the nutrition information totally free. Again, all you have to do is text OA to 303030.
Only, where do we start?
Right here. At Goofy Clown Face.
Industry, science, and technology. Big men putting screwdrivers into things, turning them and adjusting them. Build your own Atom storage box.
So just kind of defining terms, right? Browse wrap agreements are when you are browsing a website and at the bottom is a little terms of use. And it says, you know, by reading this website, you hereby agree to adopt this 37-page terms of use in perpetuity throughout the universe. And, as we've said on the show before, general rule, browse wrap agreements, not enforceable. Click wrap agreements, right, which we know of, are you have to click on the terms of use, and it's a 37-page waiver of all your rights in perpetuity throughout the universe. You have to click I accept or I agree after reading all the terms. General rule of thumb, those things are enforceable. Well, that's not good enough for all of our companies doing business online. And so sign-in wrap is the awkward, we got to find a better term for this, name for a website under which the website requires users to accept, I have read the terms of service, but the terms of service itself is contained in a hyperlink. Right. Yeah. So the website will say, by signing up on the website, you agree to our terms of service. You could view the contract by clicking the hyperlink, which is, you know, located next to a sign up button. But there's no requirement, right? Like you can just click, yeah, I've read those terms, right? Like you don't actually have to click on the hyperlink. It's not under the actual terms itself. So it's sort of one step removed from click wrap, right? And so the principal difference.
Which, I mean, Quick Wrap already, nobody reads those. So it's right. Like,
yep.
Less than nobody reads these.
Yeah, no, that is exactly right. And this is, I'm going to be talking about legal research that was done by two non-American law professors who were sort of befuddled by our system. it's sort of interesting, but I think they make a really, really neat argument, and I think this has the potential to influence sort of where our, you know, where our litigation could be headed. First, as is the case with other with click wrap agreements, sign-in wrap agreements often contain really onerous terms of limitation, right? They contain an intellectual property clause, which, you know, informs you that the website data is protected under copyright law. They contain prohibited use clauses, modification, termination, limitation of liability, disclaimers, waivers of class action lawsuit. We've talked about that before. Sometimes waivers of recovery, arbitration, forum selection, governing law, and sometimes even what are called time bar clauses, right? Which, so you ordinarily would have a statute of limitations that might run for 3 years. You can put in a contract, you have to bring any claim within a year, within 6 months. It depends on the jurisdiction, but those clauses have been upheld. And so, okay, so all of this is stuck away in terms and conditions that nobody reads. Why do we care about that? We care because the law in the United States, generally speaking, imposes a duty to read, even if they've made it hard for you to read, right? And so the way in which these kinds of sign-in wrap agreements are going to be upheld is an extension of the 13th century Saxony law provision, right? That says, and again, on the one hand, you can kind of understand this, right? It's 1938, and I hand you a contract, and it's, you know, 100 pages long, and you just skip to the bottom and you sign Thomas Smith, and then you don't do any of the stuff on the contract, right? Yeah. And totally, and then true. I go to court and I sue you for breach of contract, and you go in and go, Your Honor, this thing was 100 pages. Who the hell is going to read a 100-page contract? And the court's going to be like, well, don't sign it if you didn't read it, right? That is the common law duty to read. But that principle has been applied in the modern world in a way that gives us pause to think about the original justification. And so one case that I went and read, and this is just, I happened to pull it up. It was a case called Fateha versus Facebook. And it was a 2012 case from a Facebook user that claimed his account was deactivated based on discrimination against him on the basis of religion and ethnicity. Specifically, his allegation was, I'm a Muslim, my name was Mustafa, and that's why Facebook deleted my account. He never got to the merits of that discrimination claim against Facebook because the Facebook sign-up agreement, which even in 2012 was a sign-in wrap, said, hey, we have a forum selection clause that says any lawsuit against Facebook will be brought exclusively in Santa Clara County, California. I imagine you can tell me where that is.
Yeah, it's near me. Santa Clara, that's, you know, Bay Area, San Jose Sharks, it's all that. Yeah. It's very expensive to live there.
Yeah, and Mustafa lived in New York and sued Facebook in New York. Otherwise, he'd be able to sue them in New York. Facebook very clearly does business in New York. And Mustafa said, look, I didn't read this sign-in wrap agreement. I just signed up for my Facebook account. And the court said, quote, failure to read a contract before agreeing to its terms does not relieve a party of its obligations under the contract. So they wouldn't transfer the case. That they wouldn't maintain the case in New York. They transferred it out to California, and he dropped the lawsuit. So this might otherwise be just, you know, kind of a depressing segment of, okay, well, you know, look, like that's the law. You got to read the contract. The reality is nobody reads these contracts. And so that just means Facebook can do whatever they want. And that's why I want to do this story, because two professors wrote a law review article, conducted original academic research. These are two non-U.S. Law professors, Samuel Becker, who is a professor at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand, and Uri Benoliel, who is a law professor at the College of Law and Business in Ramat Gan in Israel, they conducted a study of the 500 largest companies that use these types of sign-in wrap agreements. And those, right, those companies include, they were drawn from the Alexa Top Sites service. They include Google, Facebook, Amazon. All of them are among the most, among the 1,000 most popular websites in the United States, right? These are mega, mega sites with the mean website hits per month during their data collection for each website was over 200 million clicks, page views, 10 million unique visitors, right? So mega companies making mega money online. And what they discovered can be summarized really, really simply. Of those 500 websites with agreements, 498 fell below the recommended readability score for consumer-related information. in other words, were incomprehensible.
Yeah.
That the contracts were written at a level that required, quote, more than 14 years of education to understand. The average readability for a sentence is supposed to be 25 words or less, and the average sentence in one of these agreements is over 70 words of length.
Yeah. The average sentence is supposed to be 25 average? That
yes.
strikes me as several words, as like a lot of words.
Yeah, right.
But that's the average legalese sentence, and they couldn't even stick to that monstrosity. That doesn't already sounds rough. They're doing 70 on average.
Yeah, and they give an example. This is a 160 word sentence. I'm gonna omit the party, but. To the greatest extent permitted by law, under no circumstances will blank its employees, contractors, or agents be liable to you in contract, tort, equity, statute, regulation, or otherwise for any loss, damage, cost, legal cost, professional, or other expenses of any nature whatsoever incurred or suffered by you or any third party, whether direct or consequential, including without limitation, any economic loss or other loss or turnover profits, business goodwill, arising out of any dispute or commercial, tortious, or other claims or proceedings made by or brought against you, which relate in any way to your access and use to any of the website materials and services, including without limitation, any relation to posts or images or any breach by you of the posting policy or image policy, or in respect of any failure or omission on the part of X to comply with its obligations as set out in these terms of use.
Oh, round of applause, everybody. Andrew just busted that out without, you know, no prep, no, there's no editing, there's no camera tricks, microphone tricks going on. He just did, there was no, Brian didn't fast forward it. Well, you know, imagine the people who listen to us on, you know, 1.5 or 2X.
On 1.5, yeah, that was just, a shout out for them.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
So that's your average sentence. No, that's still above average, but that's very bad.
Yep. So of the 500 contracts, 498 were lower than the recommended readability score. That recommended readability score is a 60, right? That's the minimum. So two were a 70. The greatest distribution of the score was between 30 and 40, right? So in other words, grossly beneath the level necessary for anybody to be able to comprehend what these agreements say. And so, okay, that's not super surprising, right? If you're pushing back, you could pick one of my contracts and it's got some legalese in it that, you know, okay, maybe it's not quite that level of monstrosity. I've written some monstrosities, right? So the law is complicated. But this is where I think this really has the potential to affect the discussion. What Becker and Benoliel are saying is, look, if the underlying document is unreadable, then it does not make sense under any theory of law to impose a duty to read something that you cannot possibly read, right? And they go through this, and I'm just going to talk a little bit about the law.
But this kind of sidesteps the click wrap, sign-in wrap, because it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, sounds like the argument is even if you were sitting here in front of me with a contract printed out, if it's unreadable, how can I be required to read it?
Yeah, but this provides a way, I think, for a court to strike a more narrow provision, right? Is to say, look, the reason why you've loaded up these terms with something that is incomprehensible and then stuck it on another page is because you know people aren't going to look at it. Because if people looked at it, they might be deterred. And we know this from an economic standpoint, because if it didn't matter to you, you would have just stuck it on the same page, right? Like, you've affirmatively made it even harder for people to view, and there must be a reason for doing so. And I would certainly feel comfortable as the court to say, yeah, so look, legalese is hard. Parsing through some of these sentences is going to be hard, and there may not be a convenient way to parse through these kinds of sentences. But at least in a click wrap agreement, at least you've put those in front of the consumer, right? At least they say, oh man, their terms of service is 36 pages long, and they can at least make a semi-informed decision. Maybe I'm not going to sign this. Maybe I am anyway. I will tell you, this is the line I draw with my client. I have clients that have online agreements, and I design for their agreements to be the click wrap kind of agreement, right? And not the sign-in wrap, right? To at least put them in front of consumers. And so, you know, the arguments are, I think the argument very concisely is, if you've produced something that if, here's how Becker and Benoglio put the argument. They say, if a court is going to impose a duty to read on the consumer, then it must impose a reciprocal duty to write in such a way that is readable, right? And notice that would only apply to these sign-in wrap agreements, right? Like, it's pretty hard when you scroll through 12 pages of text, right, to say, oh, I didn't read any of that and then I signed it, right? Like, that's a tougher duty to read argument. It's a straightforward duty to read argument when, yeah, right, they had it buried in a hyperlink. I didn't know that the hyperlink that I had to click on it, right? You know, and I thought it wouldn't let me accept it if I hadn't clicked on it. This is a way to prevent, in my view, the most abusive of those potential practices. And who knows, right? Maybe that will lead to these, you know, giant online corporations designing terms that are slightly more readable, that are slightly less onerous, and I think most critically, that are directly in front of you as a consumer.
Yeah. Wow. Well, again, it still kind of sidesteps that main issue, though, of whether the principle of doing sign-in agreements in themselves is wrong, right? Or
Yeah. No, but because remember, like, the way in which it navigates around that is because the sign-in agreement is predicated on the duty to read, right? Okay. It says,
I see.
I've signed this saying, you know, I affirm that I have read the terms and conditions before affixing my signature to it, but it doesn't check to make sure you actually have, right? And so if the common law principle of duty to read applies, then those agreements are valid. But if the common law principle also has an affirmative defense behind it, then you strike an interesting social balance, right? You're not even saying you can't do it. You're just saying, hey, if you're going to stick something behind another link, you've got an obligation to make that legible, to make that make sense to the party who's reading it. And if you don't, we're not going to strictly construe all of those terms against somebody that you were trying to get to sign up without reading those terms in the first place, right? And to me, that's the way in which progress gets made, in sort of adjusting an ancient legal principle to modern legal technology. And I could go through it, right? Like, so, because the way in which that happens is you will dig up these cases that are applying the duty to read, and they will say things like, you know, refraining from reading the contract does not constitute grounds for voiding the contract, and does not trigger the kind of mistake necessary for reformation. And then they'll give public policy opinions, right? They'll say things like, look, unless you require consumers to read the contracts before signing them, they could sign a contract and then only challenge the ones that go badly, right? And that's kind of the definition of what we don't want to have happen is, you know, to incentivize people to, you know, to mislead the other party and say, okay, heads I win, tails you lose. Mm-hmm. I'm only going to challenge this if things go south. But the nice thing is that including a duty of understandability before you impose the duty to read sidesteps all of those public policy arguments, right? If the contract is difficult to understand, then imposing a duty to read does not increase the probability that the transaction is going to be based on, you know, a well-informed decision. It restores the equities in that case, right? So it sort of responds to the reasons the court that, you know, imposed these obligations in the first place. And you know, as I've said on the show before, like law review articles, discussions among academicians, right? Like this is sometimes how the ball gets rolling. So I thought this was super interesting, and I think it's a neat area for us to track and follow.
Yeah, slightly less depressing than the Title 10 stuff. That's good. We're on an upward trajectory into Friday's episode. Does that do it? Anything else brand-spanking new patrons?
Yep, we're good.
All right, let's do it. I mentioned we took a little in-house vote, co-favorite segment of the week, thanking our new patrons at patreon.com/law, who I hope are enjoyed the Q&A and are going to enjoy Lot Awful Movies and all our other bonus stuff. And Andrew, you're up first.
All right. Thank you to Amanda Fischel, to Slarty Bartfest, Randall Holm, Mixamaster. I hope that's a Constructicon reference. To Quick, someone tell Trump that Obama couldn't solve climate change. To Humanhum Brewing. Sounds delicious. Brittany Hempel, Eric Routabush, Wendy O'Connor, and James Serve. Thomas, you take it away.
All right. Robert Muller, Covfefe is for closers, always be closing. Beth Prospero, Trent Barstad, friend of Mike the Intactivist. Oh, cool. Jesse Kearns, Beck and Chris, Crunchwrap Subpoena. I want to go get a delicious Crunchwrap Subpoena right now. That's so good. Matthew Roy, Thomas May, Andrew Nielsen, and zigsmashdiscord.me/ironknights. So there you go. Oh, good times. I love our new patrons. I love the shout outs. I want to remind people, you know, we had a few new Hall of Fame level patrons, but just a reminder, you get the new shout out for that. And then after a month, you get the repeated week by week shout out. So just to clarify, don't feel left out. That's the policy. Gotta be there for a month and then you start getting that weekly shout out.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, let's find out if my improbable streak continues over on TTTBE.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting question from a philosophical standpoint. So this was, defendant is driving his car and has a fatal heart attack, swerves across the center line, hits the plaintiff. Plaintiff sues. They go into court. They introduce those facts as, quote, undisputed. And then the question is, who wins? Does the plaintiff win because it was uncontested that the defendant swerved across the center line and struck his car? Or does the defendant win because he demonstrated that he suffered a heart attack and that's why he swerved across the line? Thomas, in looking at the answers, the first elimination you made was answer C. The plaintiff will prevail because the accident was of a type that does not ordinarily happen in the absence of negligence on the actor's part. And you said, that doesn't seem to make any sense. And I want to tell you that makes no sense. That's a nonsense garbage answer. I cannot imagine how any lawyer would or would-be lawyer or law student or listener of the show would fall for that answer. That's a terrible answer and a great
elimination. So I passed the first test. Okay.
Yes. So then you were weighing between, is the defendant going to win, referred to as the decedent, but they're both the decedent as in they're dead, and the defendant, so the being their estate. And that was answers A and B. Or is the plaintiff going to win? Answer D, which is ultimately what you chose. For a second, let me stop and kind of explain the difference. And the reason for you choosing D, I think, was driven by the fact that you really couldn't differentiate between A and B, right? You said the decedent's estate, because its rebuttal evidence is undisputed. How does that differ from the decedent's estate because the plaintiff has not established a prima facie case of liability?
Yeah, how is it different? And how? And I just, it's more like I couldn't access any, I had no information that would tell me which of those would be better. So rather than guess one of those for insufficient reasons, I chose to go with D.
Got it. So, but I want to talk about what the difference between those are, because that's what this question is testing, right? So a prima facie case means that as a plaintiff in tort, you have established all of the elements of that tort with which you have alleged against the defendant, right? And so if you don't meet a prima facie case, if you haven't met it on the pleading level, right, then that's when you grant a motion to dismiss, right? If I say, I fell down and I hurt myself, and therefore I want Thomas to pay me $1 million. That does not establish a prima facie case against you for negligence, because I haven't established that you owed me a duty, or that your actions violated that duty, right, or that your actions were the proximate cause of my injuries, right? So you would move to dismiss. I haven't met my prima facie burden. Rebuttal evidence is exactly what it sounds like. It says, okay, you've met your prima facie case, but here is something that I am offering to rebut that evidence, right? Which is, in fact, what we have here.
Okay.
So you chose D, the plaintiff, because the decedent crossed the median in violation of the statute. I think that was the most attractive distractor answer. It's incorrect. It is the most attractive distractor answer, I think, because a lot of law students will get tripped up on the question of whether that means that this is negligence per se.
Right. Right? That is kind of what I was going for. I was hoping it was like the easy exit, like, oh, okay, I'll just find my get out of this question free card. I was hoping the statute would make it negligence per se.
Yeah. So let's piece the whole story together. The plaintiff does indeed establish a prima facie case. So B is not the correct answer, right? And the prima facie case is,
even though it's the person's dead body, how does that, you know?
And that's why, right? Because they've established the prima facie case that the defendant violated the statute by crossing over the center line.
Did right? they? They were so, dead. Well, are you liable for what your dead body does? I don't know. I guess
well,
so.
Remember that the way in which the question is phrased is undisputed evidence that the decedent's car had swerved across the center line of the highway where it had collided with the plaintiff's car.
Does your car owe anybody a duty of care? I don't know.
And then the decedent introduces as rebuttal evidence, hey, I was dead.
Yeah, real sorry for the inconvenience. Just one minor note. I was dead. That's my okay.
And and that is also undisputed. So that rebuttal evidence rebuts the presumption in such a way that is inconsistent with a finding of negligence, right? As you point out, right? The hint in the question is the decedent had suffered a fatal heart attack, comma, which he had no reason to foresee.
Yeah.
Right. And so therefore it could not support a finding of negligence here, right? Because it would indeed, right? So for example, modify the hypothetical a little bit. Instead of I had a fatal heart attack that I couldn't foresee, I downed, you know, a quart of vodka and, you know, six bottles of barbiturates, right? Well, then, you know, you would have had reason to foresee that you might die.
Yeah, or like the battery in my pacemaker started beeping and then I hopped in the car or something.
Right. So
that's probably not how those work.
Yeah. No, so something where, you know, you would have a reason to foresee that it might cause you to have a heart attack would not be good rebuttal evidence here in this case. And so you might very well be liable. So defendant's going to win. Plaintiff is not in ordinary negligence terms. The plaintiff is not going to be able to recover here. Again, in modern society, you know, that would mean plaintiff would have a no fault accident and would recover something from insurance. But, you know, the law sometimes disregards the contemporary application in order for us to study the legal principles. And as a negligence action, defendant is off scot-free here. So sorry you got it wrong, man.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. But wait, which one? So you're saying it's A?
So the answer is A. Oh, did I not say that?
No, you didn't. But that's fine. So yeah, they didn't establish the, or they did establish the prima facie case, but the good rebuttal of, hey, I was dead at the time,
was undisputed. Yeah, so therefore, nobody. Defendant.
And you know, that sucks because that did jump out at me as, well, it's a weird way of saying what's happening. Like, oh, that evidence is undisputed. But it did jump out at me as like, yeah, the bar does that, though. It kind of words it in that way. And then it's you know, because like to a normal human, this is not how you would answer the question. To a normal human non-lawyer, you'd be like, oh, yeah, here's why you're liable. It's because, or you're not liable. It's because, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in the bar's eyes, it's just like, yeah, the rebuttal evidence is undisputed. So that's, you know, there's a lot of assumptions that go before that and after it. But anyway, all right. I accept it. I accept this loss. I'll come back even stronger, or perhaps exactly the same in terms of my preparation for this test.
Which does not kill you makes you exactly the same.
Yeah. That which does not kill me renders me just as able to take the test as last week. All right. Well, we better hop in your time machine. And so you can tell the listeners who our lucky winner of TTTBE is this week.
Meanwhile, at the Hall of Justice.
Well, Thomas, you're in good company. A lot of folks got this question wrong this week. Both B and D were really popular answers. The winner, however, got it right is Alpi, which is at Alpi63439230 on Twitter, who says the answer is A, prima facie case established, undisputed evidence of a statute being broken, so not B. C is nonsense, strokes and third-party dangerous driving are common causes. D is mutually inclusive with C, or so I hope. Alpi analyzed this exactly correctly. Great job. Congratulations on being this week's winner, and everyone should give him or her a follow. That is at ALPE, and you got to take these numbers down, 634-39230. I don't know if that's a phone number or something, but Alpi, thanks for playing. Congratulations on being this week's winner.
All right. Thanks so much for listening. Look forward to a lot of awful movies coming at you real soon, and of course, we'll see you for Rapid Response Friday.
See you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the assistance of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, our production assistant, Ashley Smith, and our researcher, Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez and the entire OA Wiki team. Follow them at OA Wiki. And a big thank you to our Facebook group moderators, Alicia Cook, Natalie Newell, Emily Waters, Eric Brewer, and Brian. Check out the Opening Arguments Facebook community. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith for creating the show's theme song, which is used with permission.